Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast.
Amelia Earhart returns home triumphantly. Against incredible odds, she is the first woman to have flown the Atlantic Ocean to Ireland all alone. America is crippled by the Depression, but for this brave woman, the nation gladly musters its most lavish welcome. Her courage has captured the heart and imagination of the entire world.
It's much easier to fly the Atlantic Ocean now than it was a few years ago. I expect to be able to do it in my lifetime again. Possibly not. Possibly not as a solo expedition, but in regular transatlantic service, which is inevitable in our lifetime.
Just when you thought it was safe to stop talking about Amelia Earhart. Recorded just 2 days after episode 37, Scott and Forrest rejoin us to discuss the latest developments in the Amelia Earhart case, including the theft and recovery of Amelia's terraplane in Los Angeles, the International Women's Day Amelia Earhart Barbie, and the paper that swept the world by storm by Dr. Richard Jantz. Join us for an unexpected continued discussion with Scott and Forrest of Astonishing Legends. Well, just when you thought it was safe to stop talking about Amelia Earhart, here we are. Now, to give everyone listening to this a little exposition, we just finished recording with Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess of Astonishing Legends just a couple of days ago, and we thought we were done. We thought we wouldn't see each other until the Bill Snavely podcast and Atchison later this summer. And then all hell breaks loose, as it tends to do in the Amelia Earhart Fred Noonan disappearance case, and I decided to make a phone call to Scott and Forrest and say, let's do it again. So here we are, just a couple of days after we recorded what would end up becoming part one of our Astonishing Amelia series, and now just 2 days before we release the exclusive interview with Dr. Jantz regarding the Nicomororo Bones paper, I welcome back Scott and Forrest to keep this going. Gentlemen, I didn't think I'd be saying this again so soon, but welcome back.
Thank you so much, Chris. We really appreciate it. And we're very surprised because we thought we had really bozoed up your podcast with our antics. But I thought it was a very lively and fun discussion, and we were so glad to have been a part of that.
Yes, it was. We're glad to be back because these developments that just came out, they're pretty exciting. I mean, but here's the thing. This has been brewing for a while, right? But here's the thing. Dr. Jantz's paper has been brewing for a while now, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'll give everybody a little further exposition on sort of the backstory of how this happened. About a year ago, I reached out to Dr. Jantz in the middle of the kind of the pre-research the phase one of Chasing Earhart. And, I told him who I was, what Chasing Earhart was all about, what we wanted to do, and how we wanted to feature him. And he was sort of knee-deep in his hypothesis and his paper at the time. And he said, look, I can't do it right now. I'm not really ready at this point. But when I am, and when the paper's out, when it's finished, I'll be happy to come back on your show. And lo and behold, he is a man of his word. He was very kind to us and allowed us to record with him. And we just finished that recording. And that will be out a couple of nights from tonight. So we're going to have that out. That's something that people have been waiting for quite some time now. I think it's going to be probably one of our most popular episodes and definitely one of our most listened to episodes for sure.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, the headlines were coming in from all over the world saying that it was a 99% probability that these were her bones. And this was based on Dr. Jantz's paper, which I read today, all 19 pages of it. It's pretty amazing. I was able to comprehend about 14 of them. And
14 pages or 14%?
Really? Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. It's a fascinating paper. It's super interesting. I cannot wait to hear your interview with him. I think that the work he's done is extremely diligent. I would have lots of questions for him personally, just about, for me, the biggest part of the research is that it's based on bones that are missing, that, you know, that we don't have. And I think a lot of people saw these headlines and they jumped to conclusions that this was like a DNA finding or something.
Right.
So that part of it for me is like at the very root of the foundation of the research is these artifacts that are no longer with us, and we don't even have photos of them, right? So it's based on measurements of something that's been missing a long time. So, and there's other things about the bones that make them suspect for me.
Yeah.
From the get-go. But like if you go ahead and you go with the idea that the bones existed as they were described when they were found, and they were accurately defined by D.W. Hoodless, when Dr. Hoodless, I should say, when he was the first person to put it on paper, I guess. If you go with that information, and I would say the ensuing research that Dr. Jantz has done is very impressive, and I recognize that he's a preeminent anthropological researcher. Some of our researchers in the Astonishing Research Corps who have expertise in anthropology, he was one of the very first people that she studied when she started working on her master's degree. So definitely the right guy to be looking at this stuff.
Right, but I think, you know, what's important here is that in this age of sound bites, which has been going on for maybe 20 years now.
Well, yeah, we can thank MTV for that, I think.
Yeah, it's just, and the overload of information that we get, I think it has to be done justice in that most people are going to walk away, again, you know, with this mystery solved 99% and some of these buzzwords, but to really look at what's being said here, because it isn't an important paper, I believe, but to really do it justice, you have to read it. I mean, you don't have to read the whole thing, but you have to read the summarization of more than just a sentence that's meant to get you to click on something, because that's what we see here. And that happens with a lot of our stories. Stuff will come up. We saw it with a Jaluit Dock photo. People just, they want to see one line, read one headline or read one sentence, and then file it away. Like, okay, we can all move on from this.
The need for cognitive closure.
It's the, you know, and so it's the enduring fascination with the mystery of Amelia Earhart, and, you know, again, with her life as well. You know, I think it deserves a deeper look rather than just a soundbite that we can read or hear about and then dismiss it.
Well, and before we get any further into the conversation, I'd like to give a special shout out to Katie Cohan of the ARC for helping me out with Dr. Jantz's interview and getting us the proper information so we could ask the appropriate questions. And I want to thank you guys for allowing us to utilize her for the show. It was hugely helpful, and I look forward to working with her in the future on Chasing Earhart.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we can't really tell our volunteers what to do with their free time, so. She said, I remember you saying, I said, okay, if Katie, it's like, well, we're not the boss of her. No, but she's so awesome. And everybody that works in our research group is so hungry to participate in stuff all the time. It's like, that's definitely a passion that is, it's great to find and get a hold of it. It's what helps make our show what it is. And, you know, I hope that I know that she'll ask the right questions. I've been talking to her a little bit about it too. I think for me, there's specific notes and questions that I would like to ask Dr. Jantz, and I'm sure that you and Katie will probably get to those. But I think one of the biggest questions for me was in terms of the math that comes down to this 99% probability. Actually, you have to look at this sentence. It's very specific. And to Forrest's point about clickbait, which is what all the news was, that's not the title of the paper, is not that. The title of the paper is Amelia Earhart and the Nicomororo Bone, a 1941 analysis versus modern quantitative techniques.
Yeah, and that is the heart, the spirit of this paper.
Yeah.
It is not, again, to say mystery solved, in my opinion.
Here's the difference between how we would look at this now and how it was looked at when these bones were found.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what really the paper does such a good job with, is taking a very in-depth and scientific look at how would they have been determined back then? What are the methodologies used back then? How would we do that today? And what are the shortcomings of doing this in 1940?
We haven't heard the Chasing Earhart with him yet because it hasn't been released as we're doing this now. But here's something that I'm interested in finding out. And what I was going to say was, you know, that was the title of the paper, the part of the paper that everyone latched onto. And just if you Google Amelia Earhart and Bones, you'll get 10, 15, 20 pages of results.
Sure.
Is this sentence, which I think is very important, and this is in the abstract right at the top of the paper. This analysis reveals that Earhart is more similar to the Nico Mororo Bones than 99% of individuals in a large reference sample. And the ensuing sentence says, this strongly supports the conclusion that the Nico Mororo Bones belonged to Amelia Earhart.
Right.
And that's what everyone latched on to. And that definitely, that was the headline that set the world on fire. I saw, you know, I taped the Today Show. I never have time to watch it when it's on because I've got a, you know, 9-year-old that has to go to school. But like, I'll come back and have a little piece of toast with some peanut butter and look at the first like 20 minutes of it sometimes. And it was like, it was all Earhart. It was, I was so thrilled because it was Earhart and MH370. Big stories. Yeah. I was like, yes. Like, you know, because I love this aviation stuff.
Sure.
By the way, a quick aside, this company, I think it's Ocean Infinity or something like that. They have 90 days from a few days ago to find MH370 or they don't get paid.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Yeah. Well, the times are ticking now.
Yeah, they're working on that. I hope that they find something because that'll make our episode on that a lot easier. But but it, with regard to this statement,
yeah.
I have a few questions about, you know, when I did read the whole paper, and I wasn't joking when I said I had some difficulty comprehending all the statistical breakdown of the different segments. I'm sorry, what did you want to say first?
Oh, nothing. The second part I didn't get to as far as the spirit of the paper, the heart of it. Dr. Jantz says in the abstract, which I always love, again, the terminology abstract, because it seems abstract, but it tells you what the paper's about. Right. And in the second paragraph, he states, this paper addresses two issues. One, it evaluates Hoodless's methods and Cross and Wright's support of them.
Yeah.
And we can talk about those two a little bit later. And two, it compares the Nico Mororo bones with what we can learn about Amelia Earhart's bone lengths.
Yes.
So that's kind of the second part of it, is that you're looking again at the methodology that was used after the discovery in 1940, so a 1941 analysis, and then basically supporting arguments about D.W. Hoodless's methodologies and what he would have known then and how accurate would it have been.
Yes.
Using the sources he had available to him at the time. And then the second part of this is that after we've established that and what Dr. Jantz thinks, you know, the shortcomings were, as I said before, it's then using his methodology with modern day anthropology
techniques and data.
Yeah.
And the benefit of all the hindsight.
Right. And he's going to use that and he's going to compare that with what we can kind of guesstimate with Amelia's bones. Because,
right.
of course, you know.
And a large component of this is software that he developed. I mean, this guy
is
at the king of the hill here with regard to all this stuff, and that's interesting. So, and I guess his software allows him to make large group comparisons with regard to it has a data set.
Where I was going to say he's
compiling data.
Right. One of his big points is that he has a much better and more accurate data set than what Hoodless would have been using at that time.
Which
using
would have been
one of them is from
paper.
The 1890s.
A piece of paper.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, paper, but it's
the
different.
The point is that I think he was one point of the paper was that he was stating that the measurements in general of the groupings would have not been as accurate at that time. That people basically they were underestimating the height of men and women.
Yes.
The data sets.
Well,
right?
There's a lot of things going on that they had the hindsight to discuss. And I just want to make something abundantly clear. There's a lot of very well educated people that listen to your show, Chris, and I am not one of them.
So no, well, that
I,
makes
like
two.
To, I would yeah. like to represent the layman trying to wrap their head around this. We're
right.
We're the everyman character here, but I guess for me. To your point, Forrest, what you're saying is he's able to look back and say, well, you know, since this time, we've discovered X, Y, and Z about dimorphic differences in pelvic bones, for example, which is what differentiates the pelvic bone between a man and a woman.
Right.
And the ability to determine or do what they call the sexing, trying to determine whether these bones belong to a man or a woman. Because Hoodless, who was the first person to analyze them, not the discoverer, but the first person to analyze them, had said that they belonged to a stocky male who was about 5'5". And what Dr. Jantz explains is how Dr. Hoodless may have been misguided in that observation. Not through negligence, but just all he had to deal with. His toolkit at the time was much less developed. I guess the question for me, for Dr. Jantz, is one of the biggest questions is about his sample set, which I guess consists of just under 3,000 people. And that's where this 99% figure comes from. And when you look at different parts of it, there's factors that if you're looking at it one way, then it's an 85%. And then you combine all the statistics and you come out to a 99% likelihood that this person would match. You know, again, I want to say that Earhart is more similar to the bones than 99% of individuals in a large reference sample. My biggest question, and I'm not impugning it because I don't know enough to impugn it. Right. I don't understand it well enough, is about this reference sample. Because for me, it seems like a monumental task to calculate an accurate reference sample of people that would come to an island in the middle of nowhere in the early 1900s, actually going all the way back for the case of these bones. They could have been older than they looked, going back to the 1800s or earlier and up through modern times.
Right.
And so when I'm very curious to hear what Dr. Jantz says about how he can say that these 2,700 people in this data set represent all the folks that might have come to that island.
Well, that is a consideration that he does note, who might have been on the island around that time, pre-war, you know, U.S. getting into the war. And it is a factor, but again, it's hard to extrapolate that from, you're kind of guessing.
Well, I mean,
we do know projects that have gone out there, military and otherwise, the Coast Guard
was there.
The U.S. Navy,
yeah.
Colonists, Phoenix Island natives who had visited the island for, could have been hundreds of years.
I do want to say here that in his paper, it says, it should be mentioned that a sample of Micronesian or Polynesian bone measurements was unavailable to test against the Nikumaro bones.
Right.
I consider it highly unlikely that inclusion of such a sample would have changed anything. So, and there's nothing about that doesn't make sense, but I think you do have to point out that they're not in that group for comparison, and they do have proximity to the island as much as you can have proximity to these things,
right.
These islands that are out in the middle of nowhere. But I guess for me, let's say you've made a mistake about the sex. And this is one of the things that's interesting to me, because Hoodless was convinced that it was male, and he based part of that on what they call the half subpubic angle, which is difficult for me to explain, but I think I understand. It's just there's a difference in the shape of the pelvis of a woman versus a man. And he was making a conclusion that the portion of the pelvis that they had, which was not a full pelvis, seemed like it was male. Now, Dr. Jantz talked about how there were things that Dr. Hoodless couldn't have known about certain populations having differing subpubic angles anyway. So he may have not had all the data he needed to put the right label on whether or not, or the right sex on whether or not that pelvis was male or female. On the other hand, the bones were significantly damaged from weather. They were not, they had been, I think, out in the open. They were found under a tree. There was evidence of and Chris, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, there was evidence of a fire in the area. All the bones aren't there. There was also a skull, which brings up another really interesting point that we need to talk about. But the person who first found the bones, who I believe was at Gallagher, who found the bones, who sent that first telegram.
The supervisor of the colonization or the building efforts there, I think they were brought to his attention. Now, I had read that they were actually discovered by islanders.
Yes, they were discovered by islanders, right.
Who brought them to him. He was the first one who then ordered more searching to be done for more bones.
Right. And one of the things that he said in his first telegram, which I actually took from Tiger's website, which is, again, like I've said, they're so transparent. They have so much information online. One of the first things he said, and again, this is on Tiger's website, which I admire them for their transparency. Telegram, it's from their wiki. Telegram number one, from Gallagher to Vasquez. And it says a lot. It's fascinating. You should read it. But one of the things that Gallagher says is difficult to estimate age bones owing to activities of crabs, but I'm quite certain that they are not less than 4 years old and probably much older, which is interesting because he doesn't have the trained eye, but he's essentially saying that these don't seem like these are less than 4 years old,
right.
And we are only 4 years after the disappearance of Amelia.
Well, because that assumption had been made at the time.
Right.
At least by them, is that could this be Amelia Earhart.
One of the things that's interesting about the skull, and this is something that Les Kinney pointed out, which I thought was really fascinating, and I knew that she had serious sinus problems. I remember that from the research we did when we initially covered
her. That's right.
She had
which makes the flying and the whole
a nightmare.
Physical or trauma and ordeal just so much more amazing that she went through that at all.
Well, it turns out that, you know, and we may have mentioned this back in our series. I can't remember. Chris, you're the one that's listened to that 35 times, but the I can't remember what we said about it, but she had a procedure in June of 1935 called the Caldwell-Luke procedure, if I'm saying that right. It's L-U-C.
Yeah, a drainage, right? It's meant to help sinus drainage.
Yeah, and according to Kinney, this is involves the creation of a dime-sized hole extending from the jaw through the bone into the cranium. So you would think they didn't have all of the skull, but the cranium part of that, you would think somebody would have seen, and nobody mentions that with this particular set of bones. Which,
right.
So for me, again, questions I would ask Dr. Jantz, what does he say to people saying that these bones appeared to be older? Now, I got to tell you, and today for the first time in my life, I looked up how long does it take bones to biodegrade, exposed to the ocean air on an island?
You know,
and it's not long. It's about 10 years. So
yeah.
That,
don't get arrested because that's going to
no,
be
No, I
really,
know. They're, believe yeah. me, they're already tracking my computer.
Yeah.
But it's not a long time. So I do think it's plausible that maybe they weren't that old. But being there, and again, here we come with the coconut crabs again, who had apparently damaged the bones pretty significantly.
Well, animals
so,
do, yeah. That's common on terrestrial cases, too. Animals make off with bones. That's what they do.
Yeah, and so, and Dr. Jantz was saying, you know, the damage could have been significant enough that they might have had, that Dr. Hoodless might have had a hard time identifying the subpubic angle and making the appropriate assumption or estimation about the sex of the bones. But for me, these are big questions. What if it was a male set of bones, as Dr. Hoodless originally said? Well, let's take into account Dr. Jantz's ensuing research that indicates the changes in all the data sets and populations and what different populations have differing types of pelvises. I don't know if that's pelvi. You can go ahead and
kick
me right out of anthropology school there.
Yeah.
But whatever those differences were, taking all that into account, but let's say that there are errors, which Dr. Jantz makes clear. Everyone makes errors. In fact, errors are taken into account now. Let's say one of the errors is the sex of these bones, and that these are, in fact, male bones. And there's been differing discussions on the height of this skeleton. Obviously, they don't have enough.
Right.
They have to guess about the height, and that's a whole nother, that's a good many pages of this document, of this paper that you can read. You know, there's some question as to whether Amelia was 5'7 or 5'8. She had a driver's license, I believe, that said 5'7, but then she had some pilot paperwork that indicated she might have been 5'8, or maybe it was written somewhere. So there's some varying degrees there, but let's say that you have a white male that owns this bone set, or that did, that is on that island, and then you're looking at all of the preceding visitors and inhabitants and the possibility, again coming back to this data set with these 3,000 potential people that Dr. Jantz is matching them up to, how do you know what portion of them are white males? Now, when you think about like the exploration of the region and what was going on in the world in the 1800s and the early 1900s, I think there's a fair chance that white males made it to Nicomororo. And so I think that there's some question as to that. I think there's a question as to how old these bones were. The first person that found them said they belonged to an elderly man. But again, those people were operating at a much earlier time in anthropology. It wasn't a developed science. So for me, those are my biggest questions. What if you're wrong about the sex? What if all of this is based on bones that we don't have, that we can't look at, that we don't have photographs? They're all based on Dr. Hoodless's measurements. And what we're doing here in this paper, what it seems to me that Dr. Jantz is doing, is accepting that the measurements are a good starting point and then discounting everything else that Dr. Hoodless said. So why are the measurements a safe place to jump off from? That's another question I would have.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, I think really the concrete question to ask here and what you should really start with is, what is more reliable? Here you have somebody who was not a forensic anthropologist looking at these bones, but he's actually examining the physical specimens, or you have someone who has a much better tool set and a much more detailed skill set looking at these bones and looking at these dimensions and looking at these measurements so long after the fact, what really is kind of more relevant and what makes more sense? I think that's sort of the concrete question that you have to at least start out with when you're looking at this particular case.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. When you come to that 99% probability, but you're basing some of these measurements on the inseam of old pants that she had, I mean, who knows how she had her pants cut? And maybe they asked that. I didn't see that information in the paper, but maybe she liked them a certain way. I mean, that's why you go to a tailor. And if you're a pilot, maybe the yoke is getting in the way, so the inseam is higher or lower. There's a lot of variables for me going into the analysis of the comparison of these specific bones. Even if you take the bones that were originally found, you say, okay, well, these bones definitely existed and they were accurately measured, and now we're comparing them to these old photos and clothing and stuff. It seems like there's a lot of margin for error there that would preclude a proclamation of a 99% conclusion. That's for me. But again, I have no idea what I'm doing when it comes to forensic anthropology. So,
well, yes, but in the sense, you're, you know, a rational man, as far as I can tell, and with moderate reasoning skills.
Jesus.
So, but
thanks.
Tell us how you really feel, Forrest.
After all this time we've spent together.
Yeah.
But here's what Scott and I have kind of been getting ourselves used to here, doing all the stories that we do, is like you look at the things we can understand. And what's very simple here is that these measurements are also going off of a photograph of Amelia. And it's one where she's holding, I think it's like a gallon can of
oil.
Of oil.
Mobile oil, yeah.
Right. Mobile. Right. So we know the dimensions of that can. And I believe in the photo, her shirt sleeve is rolled up. So what's happening here is that, again, we don't have her bones. We don't have the shirt she was wearing. I believe that it's the George Putnam collection did have some clothing that they allowed to be measured.
Yes.
Right? So
the waist and the inseam.
Exactly. So what you're doing, though, is you're extrapolating off of a photo of her and measuring that against, taking proportions against something she's holding in her hand. So that's an interesting aspect here, which you don't need to be an anthropologist to wonder about. Okay, it's not like we have, we have accurate measurements of her and that we have the bones themselves. Because, again, to bring up your earlier point, you're not considering some things about Hoodless's methodologies, but at least you're starting with his measurements and taking those to be accurate, because that's all we have. And, you know, the bones have since gone missing, and that's another, I don't know, you can say there's a conspiracy or a mystery in that, but we just don't have them. So it's an interesting starting point to take measurements from.
It's super exciting. Well, it's my bottom line. The thing that I want to say is that it's super exciting. Oh, there's the picture for us.
Yes, right. So, right, I've seen that. So that's...
Here's the reference.
Yeah, and one of the things that Dr. Jantz says, right... I'm sorry, Chris just sent us the picture, which is so cool. This is such a great app. One of the things that Dr. Jantz said, and I can't remember the exact phraseology, so I'm not going to try and do it, but he said you can measure the outside dimensions of what's going on here, but what you can't see and you can't do from a photo is tell where exactly the joints are and where things meet up. So there's some wiggle room there. But still, even with all that, he took all that into account with his analysis. So that's not enough to give you, based on his paper, from what I understood, to give you a large margin of error. But the other part of it, though, is I guess I do wonder, and maybe he looked into this, or maybe Rick Gillespie has, because I know that Dr. Jantz worked with Tiger to get access to a lot of this information. But there's a lot of things going on in a photo. There's the camera, there's the lens. What is the lens doing to the image? How is there a parallax view situation going on? Where is what's the camera's height relative to, like, how far off the ground is that? And I'm sure there's math to calculate a lot of that stuff. You can see how tall Fred is standing right there next to her, but he's also not standing straight up. You also can't see their feet. So there's a lot of interesting things.
Well, here's interesting aspect, because I do actually know more about photography than anthropology, believe it or not. But I've actually studied it and studied all my life. So one thing, there's a great little GIF online that you could see, and it's somebody's face taken with different focal lengths of a lens.
Yeah.
And so it used to be like a 50 millimeters was about, that approximates your normal human vision. And of course, you can get down to like 20 millimeters, and that's kind of fisheye. But most portraits are taken with, you know, 180 millimeters or more, you want to be further away. So, because what that does is it flattens out your image and people appear more flattering.
Yes.
You know, as they say, the camera adds 10 pounds. Well, that's because if they're using something that's more of a wider angle, you look fatter.
Right.
So you have a good point here in that you have to take these into account when you're analyzing a photo because things can appear differently. Now, yes, they have a replica of that can, right? And they know the exact measurements of the can. And again, that's where they're taking the relation to her arm and doing those calculations. But still, it's you're a few steps away.
Yeah,
it's a photo. It's you're going through a camera. You're going through a lens. It's not that exact. You know what I'm saying? Which to scientific degrees. So really, it is still a educated guesstimation.
Right. And I guess what I'm saying is that while there's a lot of interesting information here, I felt like that throughout the process, there's lots of little places where there's estimation happening. And there's room for a half a degree or a degree of uncertainty. And when you take all those little areas and you add them up together, it gets harder for me to wrap my head around a 99% proclamation of a match. And that is that's my biggest question for Dr. Jantz. You know, so I can't wait to hear your interview. I feel like I'm saying the same things over and over, so I should
I think you're just expressing excitement and anticipation for an interview like this. We've gotten a lot of folks that have really been interested in hearing this interview. It's probably one of our most well-tracked interviews before it even airs, and I'm sure it'll be probably our most anticipated show and our most talked about show after it airs in a couple of days. You know, I've got to say, I've talked to Dr. Jantz a couple of times over the last year or so, and of course we just connected to the interview with him. He's as nice as can be. Always very respectful, always very courteous, man of his word for coming on the show. He didn't have to do that, so we're really excited to have him on the show. I think he's more than qualified to answer all the questions that we've started posing here today.
So more qualified than we are, that's for sure.
Well.
Sorry. I interrupted you.
Well, he's more qualified than all of us, I think. You know, whether you subscribe to the hypothesis, whether you believe what he's saying, whether you agree with his findings, this is his field. It's right in his wheelhouse. It's what he does. You know, we really try to structure the interview, myself and Katie, so that we could really break this down so people could really understand the paper at a more ground level and really kind of understand what he's trying to get across. And I think that's something that, you know, it's to his credit for allowing us to kind of ask him those questions and break things down for people who don't know forensic anthropology and don't know these terms and these words and the field that he's working in. And hopefully after this interview airs, you'll have a better understanding of why he feels he arrived at the 99% number. And, you know, you'll have a better understanding of the tools and the analogy that he used to arrive at that number and why he believes that that number is accurate.
Well, one interesting thing about all that, we discussed this a tiny bit before we actually started recording here. You know, as Scott and I always say, a lot of our show boils down to belief. And you're presented with a certain set of data, and you can believe the data or not. And you can anchor your entire hypothesis on that data set and how you want to interpret it and what you believe is important. And you can leave some stuff in and you can ignore some stuff. We've certainly seen that with a lot of even more grounded theories. But again, it comes down to what's your belief line on this. And the thing that was interesting that we were discussing is that a little while ago, another group of people were analyzing a photo, and that caused a firestorm because that rubbed a lot of belief and lines of thinking the wrong way, and some people adhered to that, and some people tossed it out. But it's also, again, taking an analyzation of that analysis of the Jalowit Dock photo of the two people that appeared to be Caucasian, you know, at the end of this dock where normally you wouldn't think they would be. You know, that was looked at by facial recognition experts as well, and experts in that field. And that had a pretty solid conclusion. So, but again, if you're not buying into that, then it's all hullabaloo and you're looking at a photo of questionable dating. And here it's like the photo's not in question. And the point I wanted to make, you're basing these measurements on a photo that we know it's her. There's no question about it. You know, it's her holding an oil can, which we can get a replica of, or at least the actual oil can, and take exact measurements of that and extrapolate from that. But really, it's what I wanted to point out is that nothing has been debunked. And going back to our original point here, when you get a headline that is 99% sure, or, you know, mystery solved, one point I wanted to make, because again, the comments that we get are like, oh, well, look at this. The Jalawat photo's been debunked. It's like, no, it hasn't. And I don't believe that this is 99% solved either. But those are easy things for people to latch onto. So when it comes to the Jalawat doc photo, we had a lot of people commenting, like, well, what do you think now that the Jalawat photo has been debunked? It's like, no. No one's saying that photo is inauthentic, that it's been photoshopped or back in the day would be actually using a brush to paint people in or using photographic negative tricks, which did happen, you know, at the turn of the century and, since photography was born shortly after people were experimenting with trickery. But no one's saying that. The only thing in question about that photo on the Jalawat dock is a date that's been applied to it that is not actually on the photo itself. It appears in that travelog book underneath it that's been added. So that's what's interesting is that, again, that also seems to be an authentic photo, but it depends on the data or the idea that you take from that. And these are going in two different directions and going down two major theoretical lines.
I mean, to your point, yeah, because the date on the Jalawat photo was 1935 and she disappeared in 37. So
right.
then you get into the whole debate, just like you would with whether or not these bones, which we don't have,
right,
were what they said they were, if they were measured properly, if they were described properly. It's the same kind of thing. Well, when the date was put under that photo, was that a typo? Was that an inaccuracy?
Right.
How can you know? You can't know because it's not on the picture. So then you've got two different lines of thought. And it's the same kind of thing, I would say. There's plenty of people with other theories who could sit down with you and tell you that there's absolutely no way she ever made it to Nikumaroro based on their own personal calculations that have a whole lot of information that makes a lot of sense, in which case it doesn't matter, with all due respect to Dr. Jantz,
sure,
it would nullify the entire paper because it's impossible for her to have gotten to the island by some folks' point of view.
Right.
So it's all about figuring out how it all works together. And the dates and the times and all of this information, you get all these different people involved, and there's all, it's like the, it's like the seashell game.
Well, something that Scott brings up here is, and we talk about this a lot as well, is cognitive bias. And there's a line in here in Dr. Jantz's report where he says, cognitive bias, in parentheses, i.e., bias resulting from prior information, close parentheses, is especially problematic when making visual assessments. We do not know whether cognitive bias may have played a role in Hoodless's evaluation, but the possibility cannot be ruled out. This is also a visual evaluation.
Yeah.
Where
he's describing the same
bias
process that he's applying.
Yeah, exactly.
He's making that application to the original process of identifying and measuring the bones, but he's coming into it the exact same way.
That's what I'm saying. And so meaning no disrespect, there's, he's got a better tool set. He's got better data sets to work with. And the use of computers, the program that he himself, I think, helped develop.
Yep. FORDISC.
Right, exactly. FORDISC.
FORDISC.
Right. So I think it's much more accurate then, but we're both starting off in the same place. If you're Hoodless, you're looking at bones that you are physically measuring yourself, and hopefully you didn't make a mistake jotting anything down.
Yeah, because with his lack of, by the way, with his, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but one thing I'll make it real quick,
sure,
and you can get back on track.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to say was that I didn't say earlier was that we're discounting his instincts and his experience and his knowledge and what kind of person he was, which I don't know about. And maybe Dr. Jantz looked into that and maybe there's more information out there on that. But in addition to the fact that he had his eyes on these actual artifacts, and we're throwing out any kind of experience that got him to that point, no matter how primitive his knowledge would have been or how primitive the science would have been at that time, he still may have been really great at identifying bones.
Well, no,
but we're just going to say, well, that's not, all we're going to do is look at what these measurements,
right.
And I get that that's science. We need to just look at what we know.
Yeah.
Here's the numbers on the piece of paper. That's what we're going to analyze. But that was my point, though.
Yeah.
It seems maybe overly dismissive of Dr. Hoodless, but it's hard to know. I don't know anything about him.
I think the tone of the paper from what I read, well, one, Dr. Hoodless taught anatomy.
Right.
So for his day and age, he knew what he was talking about.
Right.
Dr. Jantz, what his point is that, anthropology wasn't a very mature science at that point. it was still nascent. So he's really good at what he does. That's, again, I'm extrapolating, you know, my feeling of the tone of the paper is that he knew what he was talking about at the time, but it wasn't as sophisticated as it is now, and we should really consider that. Now, another point of the paper, Cross and Wright, who are, I believe, two archaeologists, R.K. Wright and P.J. Cross, and they wrote a paper called The Nikumaroro Bones Identification Controversy, First-Hand Examination versus Evaluation by Proxy, - Amelia Earhart Found or Still Missing, ? And that is found in the Journal of Archaeological Science, in the reports, and that came out in 2015. Dr. Jantz makes it a point to focus on their conclusion, because their stance, I believe, from this paper is that, you know, Dr. Hoodless's conclusions should be pretty sound, and we should go with that. And he would know, that guy at least would know, if they were male or female bones. And that, because, again, if it's male and it's a short, stocky, muscular person of European descent, it's definitely not Amelia. And so that wipes out that whole discussion to begin with. So what it seems like Dr. Jantz is saying is that Cross and Wright, while accurately stating that Hoodless, you know, he was smart, a smart guy and knowledgeable for his time, we shouldn't pin all of our results on, you know, the estimation of how qualified he is, because at the outset, he's just in a wrong time. It's too long ago for these things to be really accurate. And so that's a big point of contention that he makes with their conclusion and their paper. Cross and Ryder saying that he knew what he was talking about, and that should end the discussion right there. Pretty much. It's oversimplification, but
yeah,
that's the tone that I got from this argument, which is another major part of this paper.
And what's great about Dr. Jantz's paper is that he cites all those preceding papers that agreed or disagreed with Hoodless's original analysis. And you can look it all up and read it all for yourself and draw your own conclusions, which is what we always encourage everybody to do.
So here comes a really short question, a really basic foundational question, and probably I'm going to get a really complex answer. But those are the kind of answers we like. And the question is this: is, in your eyes, is this case closed? Is this mystery solved?
For me, it's not solved, but there's a couple of reasons for that. That's not just pure knee-jerk denial reaction. I just feel like we need more information. I think that the biggest problem with it for me is what it's based on and the fact that we can't get to the original artifacts. And all we have is this written description of them. And I guess I just feel like from the experience that we have, the experience that we do have, what we do know, and we've been at it a few years now, is exploring mysteries like this. And we've come across a lot of common ground when it comes to the origins of things and what you can trust and what you can't trust. And for me, if we're making a lot of assumptions about the original discovery of these bones that were found by one person, sent to another person, measured by the other person, seen by someone else, and then lost. And then we're going to take that and decide from that original thing that the mystery is 99% solved. I just can't get there from here, although I have tremendous respect for Dr. Jantz's paper, and I think it is incredibly you can't put a value on how useful it is to the overall search. I think it's very important, and I think everyone should consider the possibility that Amelia did die a castaway on Nikumaroro. It's a possibility as much as any of these other possibilities until we find bones that we can put our hands on or an Electra 10E sitting somewhere where, and even when we find that, if she's not in the plane or near the plane, or then there's a whole nother mystery. So it's so much more complex to me than one paper or one study or one location. And I think when you look at the whole of all the information that's come out from the various hypotheses and theories from all the different places, it's really hard right now to say that one is more on track than the other. They all have things that you can deconstruct and say, well, I don't know. And then some of them have things where you're just like, this seems pretty amazing. And
well, so even
it's not solved for me.
Yeah, because even in the last discussion, you know, the question came up, what's the most outlandish tinfoil hat not going there theory? And it's like, if you combine some of these, it gets really crazy. But the ones where, you know, again, the only thing we could think of maybe was Irene Bolam. But the point is that there are some really interesting clues or factoids or things you bump up against that really make you wonder about that. You can't toss it out completely. And so as crazy as that sounds, you come across something that's like, wow, that one's really hard to dismiss. I don't know what to think about it. I mean, certainly you're not going to maybe jump on board if you're not invested with that. But when we try to consider everything, and that's all we ever try to do here, is just consider all the possibilities and then make it a judgment on it, is that you can't toss everything out, and there are some things that really just make you think. And now, from my point of view here, I see a couple of unfortunate things going on. One is it is an overly voracious media cycle going on that latches onto these things, and the terms like clickbait come up, and sound bites that we've mentioned before. And so that's kind of what's happening here, is that this whole thing blows up and it gets passed around and assumptions are made without really reading or looking into things. And that, again, I think that's unfortunate to the real story, the mystery, her legacy, her memory, all these things, because we always look for the truth and try and consider all the options on the table. So when something that says, and I think maybe this is an unfortunate part of this forthcoming of information in this paper, is that declaration gets really cemented, and that's the only thing that people remember. And it depends a lot, again, on what you, these little clues that you want to take and run with. Because in my view of this whole thing, my summation is that it's another really interesting clue to this mystery, but it doesn't solve anything. It's like you go to a crime scene and here's a fingerprint, but we don't know whose it is. We just know it doesn't belong here, doesn't match. It's just something really to pay attention to. It's another direction to look towards it, but it doesn't solve the mystery of anything. Now, another thing that's been brought up that's also included in a lot of these online articles, especially, are a few other artifacts that have been discovered on Nicomororo. And one of the most famous thing, or the one that stands out, of course, because it's got a funny name, is the jar that is supposedly Dr. C.H. Berry's freckle ointment.
Right.
And you'll see photographs, and this is on the Tiger website as well. It's saying like, well, this is pretty likely that, it's well known that Amelia, and we talked about this a little bit before, but, Amelia really disliked her freckles, and it's likely that she would have carried something to kind of to alleviate that. And by the advertising on the jar, it was guaranteed to get rid of your freckles. And yes, so a jar was found on the island that is pretty much the shape of this Dr. Berry's freckle ointment, except for a big difference. The jar that was found in pieces, in about four pieces, in five pieces, the fifth piece being found about 80 feet away from the original site where it was discovered.
Crabs.
A turtle. It was next to some turtle bones. Like, yeah. Now you laugh at that, but I'm coming to that point.
Okay.
The fact is that the jar that was found was clear, was transparent, had no label on it anymore, of course. But the jar that was found of the actual Dr. C.H. Berry's freckle ointment is an opaque white jar. Now, they are very similar in shape, maybe identical. Maybe it was the same glass used for different cosmetic purposes. But it is not the same thing. The original Dr. C.H. Berry's freckle ointment jar was an opaque white color. So okay. It was not clear. It was
and the
white.
One that was on the island
was clear.
There we go.
So that's a major difference. That can't be reconciled as far as we know. At least Tiger has not been able to do it.
It's a little tiny leap. And then when you add up lots of little tiny leaps, you wonder where you're at.
That is my point. And I believe Rick Gillespie has said, no, I can see the reasoning in all this, but it's, and I'll go a certain distance with it. 80 feet to a pile of turtle bones, sure. Because that's what was found. But Rick was also saying that, well, the fifth piece in that broken jar, now the bottoms were melted a little bit, so they conclude that maybe some water was being boiled to make it drinkable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's evident. That's evidence. And, but he was saying that the fifth piece was maybe used as a cutting tool to eat this turtle. because the piece was found next to the turtle bones, 80 feet away.
Also, well, though, but, there was a spring, like 80 feet, or not 80 feet, but sorry.
You mean a water
there was
spring?
Yeah, there was water not far from... Right. I mean, if you're boiling water in it, you certainly didn't look very hard for water.
Well, depends on how brackish it was, maybe.
Well, and here's my other question is about the... Okay, she didn't like her freckles. She's flying around the world with sinus problems and dysentery, and she's taking freckle cream. I don't know. She just doesn't strike me as somebody who needs to put on freckle cream well, so that she can land in Papua New Guinea and make sure her freckles are going away. She doesn't... No matter how much she didn't like them, she doesn't strike me as being that... vain,
she's
frankly, and
she's
concerned
no.
with her vanity. I think she's more concerned with being an, you know, an aviatrix and a groundbreaking woman, and
she
less
knew,
about
well,
her freckles. But
yeah, that's
what
my
do
point.
I don't know. I didn't know her.
Well,
you
no,
knew her
but,
better
but,
than we did.
But
Chris,
here, but. No, Scott. Here's my point. She's counting almost every ounce that's going onto that plane.
Right. She's throwing out life rafts, throwing off, you know, radios and all this stuff, and she's keeping freckle cream. I don't know. I just
well, the, okay. Know. So that to wrap that point up though is it, I think it illustrates that you find something that you're excited about. A small aspect of this mystery, a clue of one of many, and you're running with it. And so, you know, when you find this photo, look, we can extrapolate the bone measurements and the height of the full skeleton and thus the person. But you're starting off with something that's almost intangible. It's a set of written down numbers somewhere in an old journal that we just it's not enough for me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. We feel we're on the same page.
Well,
that.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting to. And then people, I think when we direct them to read more about it, they're like, oh, well, I kind of thought there was DNA evidence. No. Because when you get to numbers
there's
like
not
90
even bones.
No, that's what I'm
not
saying.
Not only is there not DNA, yeah. There's no bones.
When you get to numbers like 99%, you know, kills all germs 99.9%. The reason they say that is because they can't actually say 100%. I think that's a point you brought up before.
Yeah,
Listerine used to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, they got busted.
That's as close as we're going to get. We can't actually say 100% because we've solved the mystery of the common cold, and it's in this bottle for $4.95. You can't say that. And so you get close, but that's kind of dangerous terms here because then that's letting people know, again, who aren't looking into this, that... Oh, this is all done, and we've solved this mystery. It's like no, it's again, it's another great piece of the puzzle. It's some great detective work. It's some great forensic work.
Yeah,
and some great scholarship, but it doesn't solve anything for me. It's just I'm so glad it's there. I'm glad somebody went to the trouble to do all this, like all these other pieces. But you still got to take a step back and approach and consider everything.
So the short answer to that question is no, it's not solved.
Not for either one of us.
You know, Scott, you probably could have just said that, make it a lot easier on us.
Yeah, they can just fast forward. You should put a marker so they can just skip ahead to that.
No,
figure.
Well, that's it, you know, but that's the thing. It's like we, you know, obviously not for us, but there are a lot of people who are invested in the Nikumaroro theory, and that's going to be enough for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That'll be mystery solved for them. Now the next step is. Now we actually got to find something.
Where's the plane?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, next thing is we got to find either more bones, more evidence. And really, at this point, it's got to come down to DNA.
Yeah.
You know,
you're not going to find it, though. It's been 80, how many years? 81?
80, well,
it's been going on 81 years. Yeah.
81. It's been 81 years. You're not going to find it. You got those crazy crabs that haul bowling balls off. You're not going to find it. If they carry the bones down in the ocean, they eat them, and they were exposed to the elements, you're not going to find them.
But here's the bigger picture that I always thought about, even as a kid, and with books like Blue of Capricorn, which I gave you, mm-hmm. which kind of highlights something my dad always instilled in me, is that the oceans, the most of our planet, 70%, is such a mysterious place and such strange things happen out there.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's all bets are off the table. Such weird phenomena happen.
Sure.
Because, again, it's a world we're still just discovering. What's on top, what's underneath,
mm-hmm.
how it all behaves. And that things on a remote island, I've heard of the strangest things happening from people, from sailors, guys in the Navy. Who are trusty shellbacks, been past the equator, knowledgeable guys, been in years and years, and they'll tell you some of the strangest things that you've ever heard
right.
happening out there in the big open blue oceans. It's just a world there. Again, you can take into things like taphonomic modification, you know, on the bones, the weathering, this and that. Those things we can calculate, but just what shows up on a tiny island and either take something or leave something.
The final thing I guess that I want to say is that I wish we could put together a model. Everyone is so encapsulated in their own camps and their own theories and their own ideas. And I always come back to the analogy of different intelligence services not talking to each other, like in the run-up to 9/11, and how everyone has this really amazing information, but it's locked in this corridor. And to me, it seems like it would be really useful to see the common ground that all the different hypotheses have right now. I would love to see just like a matrix on a big whiteboard that's like, okay, well, here's this, here's theory A, and here's theory B, and here's three elements that work for both of them. And here's the other ones, or one of those three-dimensional maps that they do with software now that shows relationships between where everything is like a sphere and there's lines that connect it all. I feel like if somebody were to start and really try to connect everything that was going on, even though that gets convoluted and it runs away from Occam's razor, it may create some kind of new ideas about the different possibilities.
Right.
And so that's the last thing I wanted to say about, you know, it's more for me than Dr. Jantz's paper or Airplane X here or the witnesses in Saipan. It's the question of how much of all this stuff might play together from a standpoint of logic.
And I'm not a huge fan of Occam's razor either, because yeah. You know, here's the other thing, it could be incredibly complex.
Yeah.
The final answer to all this, if we ever get around to finding out all the bits of it, and we may not, because that incredibly complex answer will not have everything, I think, for public consumption. That's my thinking. If it goes down that line, if the truth lies there, there are things we'll never know about it, but it'll be wild. I'll guarantee you that.
Well, enough about the Dr. Jantz paper. We're going to get more into that in just a couple of days with the man himself, who is going to grace our show and talk about the paper in great detail. And we'll hopefully have some answers for you guys on the questions you posed this evening. But let's now move on to something that I know Scott is very excited about, perhaps more excited than the Jantz paper itself. And that is the announcement that Mattel is finally making an Amelia Earhart Barbie for International Women's Day. Scott, I know you're dying to tell everybody about it. Let's get into Mattel and the Barbie Amelia Earhart.
Well, yeah, so there's a special Barbie inspiring women from all different walks of life, including, in addition to Amelia, Frida Kahlo, and also Katherine Johnson, which if you saw Hidden Figures, you'll know who that is. She was kind of the genius there behind the scenes, mathematical genius. It's very fascinating. So did you know Frida Kahlo was in a horrible bus accident and spent a lot of time in...
Yeah.
Like her legs were broken in like 50 places.
Well,
yeah, amazing.
Right. And yeah. And of course, there's some controversy surrounding her doll.
Yeah.
I believe from the family members. I hope there's none with Amelia.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. You know, this is not the first Amelia Earhart doll. There have been unofficial Amelia Earhart dolls that have been sold for many, many, many years. They're usually very popular in nature, and I think it's something that Mattel has been pressured to do for quite some time, to include Amelia as a doll. And I think it was really proven to them that once this Amelia Earhart doll came out, it was the only one that I know of that actually sold out for pre-order, which is really exciting.
Sure. Yeah, it's pretty
cool.
So
it's one of those things where it just proves Amelia's relevance in pop culture today.
So many of you are inspired by these role models. We have unfortunately sold out of this doll. That's the Amelia one. Click below and we will notify you when she's back in stock.
And of course, something else in the news regarding Amelia Earhart, her 1932 SX Terraplane was stolen and then recovered a few days later in East Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Now, this Terraplane was owned, of course, by Jim Summers, who was a project guest of Chasing Earhart. He's one of the original people that we shot with early on in the project when we first started shooting the documentary. So we're super happy as a team that he got his car back, which is really, I know it meant a lot to him personally. And we're hoping that he's going to be bringing that car to Atchison this summer, which would be really exciting.
Yeah, they hired her to help roll that model out, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what was interesting about it is I think once they realized what they had in their possession, they didn't want any part of it. So they basically abandoned it, but as safe as you can, they put a car cover over it on the streets in El Monte, and they walked away from the car.
Oh, so they did cover it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was found on February 26th of 2018 and parked on a street in El Sereno, which is a neighborhood here. It's actually a neighborhood close to Cal State, L.A., and here in Southern California, kind of east of metropolitan LA, and it was found unharmed. But I was talking to Scott about this earlier, which I thought was an interesting aspect. It's like somebody, you know, it's like if you steal a crate or you break into something, it's like, you know, oh, here's a Van Gogh. It's like, well, what do you do with that? You're not going to be able to, you know, sell that on the street very easily because it's going to have to go to a collector. You know, if you parted it out, it's not going to be worth that much. This thing, the estimates on the worth currently are between $250,000 to $500,000. It's only one of 14 models still known to exist. And what are you going to do with it? So obviously they get it. I'm glad they covered it, you know, and it was not what we were expecting. Nice piece, but we're going to leave it here and somebody will find it. And actually, I think it was a viewer, a CBS LA viewer that saw the news piece. Yeah, called it in, and thank goodness it was found. And so you're saying it's back with Jim Summers, right?
Yes. As of this recording, it is safe. It is back in Jim's possession. And, you know, guys, this just really sort of proves kind of what Chasing Earhart always talks about when it comes to Amelia's relevance in pop culture, in history, and in just general relevance in the 21st century. You have all these stories that come out. I was telling my wife, you know, a couple weeks ago, this is like the trifecta. You have an Earhart disappearance case story that comes out with the Dr. Jantz paper. You've got a human nature story when it comes to her SX Terraplane getting stolen. You have the pop culture reference when it comes to Mattel creating the International Women's Day, including Amelia and the Barbie set. You've got Brad Meltzer's incredible project for I Am Amelia Earhart, the Lego set that just achieved its 10,000 signatures.
Yeah.
And you just have all of these incredible things going on with Amelia Earhart, multiple stories at any given time regarding any various aspects of her life or her disappearance or the aftermath of that. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, that's why I'm excited to see projects still being done in her name and in her spirit, like the Barbie doll, like the Lego set that's being proposed. What a great project. But what I love is that it's a reminder to the older generation and an introduction to the newer generations coming up that here's somebody you should look up to because they actually did something. It's not, they're not just famous for being famous or just a pop media icon that will be here and gone later today, but it's somebody who accomplished amazing feats and still would be if things hadn't turned out the way they were. Or, you know, you asked me last time, it's like, what do you think Amelia would be thinking?
Yeah.
At that point, it's like, man, if it was right after, say, wherever she ended up, you know, either as a castaway or you know, in Saipan, wherever she was, I think it's like, okay, what happened? What do I got to fix? And the next question is, how do I get back up in the air as soon as possible?
Yeah.
Because that's what she was all about. And that's why it's exciting to see this project going on and her name coming up and people being inspired by her. And oh yeah, we had a couple of terrific fans at our LA meetup, Wendy and Cass, who are sisters, and they created an Amelia doll
themselves.
Yeah, themselves. This one stands about, it's a little over a foot tall, maybe about 18 inches, but it's got the goggles, the jacket, the scarf. It's just really terrific. And they just did it on their own. They're just like, well, this would be a fun project. And what a great icon to, you know, to build a doll around and to create something.
You know, it's fascinating. In addition to Amelia, I guess Roy Chapin gave Orville Wright the very first Terraplane off the assembly line. So they, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, didn't it have aspects of it that were something kind of akin to airplane manufacturing? It had a very tight specs on it.
Yeah, it was very precisely built, and right. That was how they marketed it. And you know, that's the name Terraplane. And in fact, they
ground plane, right?
They had, yeah. It's, you know, I'm kind of a car nerd, so I'm okay.
And as I said, that car, hopefully, we're working on the details right now, but hopefully, we can get that car in Atchison so you guys can check it out in person.
So you're not gonna let us drive it around while we're in town?
Well, you never know.
Well, just the insurance alone, I don't want to have to make any payments should you ding that thing.
Listen to the sales slogan, 1933 for it. Yeah. On the sea, that's aquaplaning. In the air, that's aeroplaning. But on the land, in the traffic, on the hills, hot diggity dog, that's terraplaning.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is the forefront of 1930s advertising technology.
All right.
Well, that's going to do it. I think this was a productive conversation tonight. I really want to thank you guys, Scott and Forrest from Astonishing Legends. I know how busy you guys are. I know you have your own recording schedule. I really appreciate you coming back on the show and sitting in with us to discuss the latest developments of the Earhart case. We are going to be hearing from Dr. Jantz in just a couple of short days, and we're going to be digesting that paper and putting that out for everybody to sort of just take in and hopefully understand a little bit better so that we can kind of break it down further for everybody. But gentlemen, thanks again. You guys are, like I said in the beginning, you guys are friends. You're more than project guests. I really appreciate you guys coming on tonight.
Well, thanks for having us back, Chris. And, you know, anytime, and you can deflect all the angry emails to, you can just forward them to us. We've got a whole inbox full of them.
So. Oh, yes. We love to read them and then, you know, yeah, take a while to respond. But we're really honored that you would include us in this project to begin with. And, you know, it's a lot of fun just coming on here and discussing more of a discussion, really. I mean, because it's not like, again, we're not writing books about it, but we love talking about it, and especially with you, because it's, you know, you're so knowledgeable about every aspect of this. We can bring something up and like, yeah, Chris knows about that.
Well, that's very kind of you, Forrest. I appreciate that. You know, you guys are sort of the ones that started this all for us way back in 2014 when I was looking for a model to do the show. You guys set the bar, and I'm really appreciative. I'm really forever in debt to you guys that you would, one, just agree to be part of the project as project guests, and two, become as good of friends that you guys have become. And I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in Atchison. It's going to be a blast.
Well, I think that was our first big breakout show. You know, early on when people would ask us, it's like, well, where should I start? What episode should I pick? It's like, well, why don't you start with Amelia? Because that was the first time I think we got serious about stuff and really dove down deep and got kind of lost in the lore and the legend and all that, and really had a good time with it. But, you know, I don't know if it's our pinnacle show, but something we're really proud of and proud to have chosen the topic and followed it as far as we have. So it's just an ongoing continuation of a great adventure, and we're glad to be a part of it.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join us in just 2 days on April 14th for the interview that everyone has been talking about, the Chasing Earhart exclusive with Dr. Richard Jantz. Thanks for listening.